Chapter 10.
The title of this chapter is The Opulences of the Absolute. In the beginning verses of this chapter, I can maybe just read it quickly. Krishna has been very openly describing his own position in the universe, but not in the universe, in reality. Where began text 1, the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Listen again, O mighty armed Arjuna, because you are my dear friend. For your benefit I shall speak to you further, giving knowledge that is better than what I have already explained. Neither the hosts of the demigods, nor the great sages, nor my origin, or opulences, for in every respect I am the source of the demigods and the sages. He who knows me as the unborn, as the beginningless, as the supreme lord of all the worlds, he only undiluted among men is freed from all sins. Intelligence, knowledge, freedom from doubt and delusion, forgiveness, truthfulness, control of the senses, control of the mind, happiness and distress, birth, death, fear, fearlessness, nonviolence, equanimity, satisfaction, austerity, charity, fame, and infamy. All these various qualities of living beings are created by me alone. The seven great sages, and before them the four other great sages, and the Manus, the progenitors of mankind, come from me, born from my mind. And all the living beings populating the various planets descend from them." One who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mind engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. Of course, you may notice in the Sanskrit, he says, is engaged in yoga, yogena tena. Doesn't exactly say, but avikalpena yogena, without diversion, unalloyed. Prabhupada translates this yoga as devotional service. But now, the next verses, we'll see why this is devotional service. The next four verses are considered to be the central four verses of the Bhagavad Gita. Sometimes they're described as Bhagavad Gita in a nutshell. So we begin with text 8. This done the previous give you the context of this of these verses. So text 8, aham sarvasya prabhavo mata sarvam pravartate itti matva bhajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. That's the first line. Aham sarvasya prabhavo. I am the source of everything. Matta sarvam pravartate. Everything emanates from me. Iti matmam. Knowing this, the wise who know this perfectly. The wise is at the Buddha. Again, we have the word Buddha. The wise who perfectly know this. Engage in my devotional service and worship me with all their hearts. So this is the reaction to understanding who Krishna is, what his actual position is. This is the reaction. Itti matva, thus understanding this or knowing this, that Krishna is the source of everything and everything emanates from him, those who are wise bhajante ma, they worship me, bhava samanvitaha, with their whole hearts, or with great attention, with great absorption. And because they are now understanding that Krishna as the personality, the supreme personality of Godhead, is not just one among many or some other person, but is actually the source of everything. Everything is his energies. One should understand, this is a topic of great concern in theology. What is the relationship between God and the world? There are various ways of expressing this. It's a kind of an important topic. Some say God and the world are identical. That's called pantheism. Some say there's only God and no world. That's called monism, or idealistic monism. Some say there's God in the world and really they're not very much connected. And so on. The philosophy taught in the Bhagavad Gita, in different places, Krishna has mentioned this, that, as he says, all things are in me, but I am not in them. What this means to say is, we gave the example how Krishna is the source of everything, because everything is his energy. We give the example of the sun and the sunshine. The sun is the energetic source, and the sunshine is the energy, the heat and the light that come from the sun. So what is the relationship between the energetic source and the energy? Well, on the one hand, we make a distinction. We have to. The sunshine is in the room. That doesn't mean that the sun globe is in the room. So there's a difference between the sun and the sunshine. On the other hand, where does the one end and the other begin? You actually can't separate them. They're a unified process. So this relationship is the same similar relationship between Krishna and his energies. This is called Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva, the principle of inconceivable and simultaneous oneness and difference. Inconceivable because actually our material minds cannot really wrap around this. But I will give you a couple of places, I've found these sentences in Prabhupada, which actually express it very nicely, and which you can just think about. At the end of the Bhagavad Gita, in the very last purport, there's this expression, nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. Like a Zen koan. You can just think that way. Prabhupada said once, don't see a tree, see Krishna. That is, to really understand the tree fully as it is, you have to see this tree as Krishna's energy. There's the spiritual energy, the soul, there's the material energy, there's the whole system of transmigration. So nothing is different from Krishna, yet Krishna is different from everything. And another place, Prabhupada put it like this, there is nothing but Sri Krishna. Yet nothing is Sri Krishna save and except his own primeval personality. It's a little more complicated, huh? I'll say it again. There's nothing but Sri Krishna. Yet nothing is Sri Krishna save and except his own primordial personality. So you can just repeat those, look around, see how this is how I should see the world, huh? So this means, because everything is Krishna's energy, the idea sometimes is expressed about Brahman, the absolute truth, is one without a second. I mean, that's the meaning of absolute, right? Because there's contrasting terms. There's absolute and there's relative. When something is relative, there's at least two things and there's a relationship. So philosophers and sages, thinking about that, have said, well, if we are dealing with the absolute truth and it's not related to anything else, then that's all that there is. Ekam eva advitiya Brahman. Brahman is that thing which is one without any second thing. So we agree. There's nothing but Sri Krishna. Krishna includes his energies, and so Krishna, if we say Krishna and Krishna's energies, that's all that there is. We've exhausted reality. Or in the Hare Krishna mantra, the word Hare is the energies and Krishna is Krishna. So you say Hare Krishna, you've just said everything. Krishna and Krishna's energies. So the energies of Krishna, this world, even though it's material energy, they are, since they are Krishna's energies, they're related to him. Ultimately, in a higher sense, they're all spiritual. And even though we take all the energies together, still Krishna is more than his energies. There's nothing but Sri Krishna, yet nothing is Sri Krishna, save and except his own primordial personality. He includes the worlds, and he also is beyond it. Well, like for example, if you take the religions that come from the Near East, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, they tend to separate Krishna from his energies. The Christians have the doctrine that God created the world, but it didn't come from him, but it was created ex nihilo, from nothing. It's not really ultimately divine. Ultimately, this is an incomprehensible doctrine, but that's what they teach. And the same way with Islam. Islam says that God and the world never come into contact. The world is completely mundane, secular, separated from God. There's only one place only, is there ever a little touch. That's the Quran. Otherwise, completely separate. So the teachings are like this. And if they hear our doctrine, they say, well, that's pantheism, isn't it? That's nature worship. But it's not, because we also understand that God is transcendent. He's both transcendent, beyond the world, and immanent. He's present in the world at the same time. So his energies are all pervading, and yet he is there in his transcendental position. So all this is expressed, I am the source of all spiritual and material worlds. Everything emanates from me. See, this word emanation is being used here. Everything emanates from me. The word for creation used in the Bhagavad Gita, Srijam, Shrij, to send forth. Sarga comes from this creation. So first those who are wise who appreciate that Krishna is actually the ultimate source of all these energies, and who ultimately includes them, is in fact manifest as a transcendent person, Krishna. So appreciating him, so he says they appreciate him bhava samanvita, with great attention, or with all their hearts, or with great feeling. How much so? This is described in the next verse, text 9. Mat chitta mat gata prana bodayanta parasparam kantayantas chamam nityam tushanti cha ramante cha. The thoughts of my pure devotees dwell in me. Their lives are fully devoted to my service. They derive great satisfaction and bliss from always enlightening one another and conversing about me. This is the extent. Once you understand who Krishna is, you will cannot help but fall in love with him. Absolutely. All you got to do is clear away all the garbage and all the misconceptions, and understand Krishna as he is. And actually, we will discover that he's the one that we always loved. We just didn't know it. And now here our love, bottled up inside, never know where to go, has now find its real object. So these are people in love with Krishna. But they're in love with Krishna, they cannot stop talking about him. They're obsessed. They cannot stop talking about them. They cannot stop serving him. And when they're together with each other, they talk to each other among themselves and enlighten one another. Bodhayanti, they enlighten one another. And in doing so, tushante ta ramante cha, they become greatly satisfied, in fact, ecstatic. This is their behavior. Now, so here the first two verses have been describing the devotees who have now risen to the platform of full knowledge of Krishna. Then the next verse, Krishna now talks how he reciprocates with the devotees who do this. The devotees are like this. How is Krishna, what is his attitude toward them? Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam prittipurvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yenamam upayanti te. To those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love, I give the understanding by which they can come to me. Now this is the understanding by which I can come, they come to me. The word in Sanskrit is I give dadami. See, this is the third line there in the Sanskrit text. Dadami, and what's the word? Buddhi yogam tam. Remember buddhi yoga from the second chapter? Here it is again. I give them the intelligence. Dadami, I give it to them, this buddhi yoga. I guide and direct their intelligence so that they can come to me. And Krishna Prabhupada says, in this verse, the word buddhi yogam is very significant. We may remember that in the second chapter, the Lord instructing Arjuna said that he had spoken to him of many things and that he would instruct him in the way of buddhi yoga. Now buddhi yoga is explained. Buddhi yoga itself is the action in Krishna consciousness that is the highest intelligence. Buddhi means intelligence and yoga means mystic activities or mystic elevation. When one tries to go back home, back to Godhead, and takes fully to Krishna consciousness, in devotional services, activities are called buddhi yoga. In other words, buddhi yoga is the process by which one gets out of the entanglement of this material world. The ultimate goal of progress is Krishna. People do not know this, therefore the association of devotees and a bona fide spiritual master are important. One should know that the goal is Krishna, and when the goal is assigned, then the path is slowly but progressively traversed and the ultimate goal is achieved. And now Prabhupada gives a review of this yoga ladder that we discussed. When a person knows the goal of life but is addicted to the fruits of his activities, he's acting in karma yoga. He knows it should be Krishna, he's now trying to give up his attachment to the fruits of activity. So this is called karma yoga. When he knows that the goal is Krishna but takes pleasure in mental speculations to understand Krishna, he is acting in jnana yoga. And when he knows the goal and seeks Krishna completely in Krishna consciousness and devotional service, he is acting in bhakti yoga or buddhi yoga, which is the complete yoga. This complete yoga is the highest perfectional stage of life. What Krishna is saying is, I give the understanding, I give the intelligence. Now this buddhi is one of the faculties we have Remember, we talked about the subtle body consisting of manas, mind, and then buddhi, intelligence, and then above that, our a sense of self, or ahankara. So this buddhi, intelligence, is the ability, is the faculty which directs our attention, or determines our whole mindsets or paradigms, how we think of things in a comprehensive way. And we discussed earlier a verse which said, Prabhupada said, one class of persons is intelligent in material activities and another is intelligent in spiritual activities. It means their whole direction of their mind is either this way or that way. And that what determines the whole direction of one's mind, one's all preconceptions, the whole system of categories, the whole way we see the world as a unified whole, that is buddhi. And this intelligence, ultimately this intelligence that we have, is the form in which the super soul directs us. We are in this body, and also Krishna is in this body as the super soul. We cannot do anything without the help of the super soul. Later on in the 15th chapter of this Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am situated in everyone's heart. This is 15:15. And from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. Sarvasya cha aham hridi sannivisto matas mitra jnanam apohanam cha. I'm situated in everyone's heart, in the heart of every living entity, and for me comes smritri. This means, as explained, remembrance of Krishna. Jnana, transcendental knowledge, but also apohanam, forgetfulness, shoving aside. So Prabhupada explains that when we want to remember Krishna, it is Krishna acting from within as the super soul through the agency of intelligence. It is Krishna who gives us all the facility to remember him. And that's what he's saying in this verse. I give them the understanding by which they think. When they return our attention to Krishna, we have some freedom. Which way we want to go, that's ultimately our decision. It is not Krishna's decision. We have some minute independence. It is described that when the living entity comes into the material world, it's with the purpose of forgetting Krishna. It's for the purpose of enacting our own God projects, to become competitors. And so that's why one ends up in this world of birth and death, because one has become a competitive Krishna. But even though we want to forget Krishna, in fact, because we want to forget Krishna, it is Krishna who causes our forgetfulness. We have become covered by Maya, and that Maya is Krishna's energy, and Krishna covers us with Maya because we want to forget Krishna. Because I am the servant of Krishna, but I would like to be the master. I would like to be God, as the God project that's going on here. To become the supreme, become better than everybody else, engaging in competitive sense gratification, become king of the mountain, the top dog, and so on. Lord it over material nature, Prabhupada said. Well, I can't become Krishna, their position is taken. I'm not qualified for that. And so Krishna says, okay, I will give you the illusion, or you can forget me, and now you can pretend to be the Supreme. So he lets we look at this material world as our playground that we're going to dominate and control, and so on. So that forgetfulness comes from Krishna. It's Krishna's energy that covers us. The living entity is in the body and transmigrates from one body to another. Super soul accompanies us. We are not alone. There's two of us inside. I'm looking out of these eyes, and so is Krishna, the super soul. This is described in the Upanishads that there are two birds sitting in a tree. The one bird eats the fruits of the tree, and the other bird just watches. It's just the witness, the sakshi, the witness. And the bird hops from tree to tree or branch to branch, that is, changing bodies, eating the fruit. The fruit is of two kinds, sweet and bitter. That is pleasure and pain. And the other bird just goes along with him. So with that sort of allegory, they describe the soul and the super soul. What is he doing? Waiting for us to turn back. And as soon as somewhere inside we decide, I want to remember Krishna, I understand now, I want to give up this God project, I want to reconcile myself, then the super soul gives us all the facility to remember. I mean, so I'm situated in every from one's heart, from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. So here in this text that we're looking at today in the 10th chapter, see, Krishna says about the devotees, they have turned toward me, they have learned about me, they're attracted to me, they want to come closer and closer, they want to advance in spiritual knowledge. How do they do it? I help them. This is why bhakti yoga is considered to be the most doable of all spiritual processes, as well as the most powerful, because the devotee is not alone. It's not a do-it-yourself project, where you lift yourself up by your own bootstraps. Rather, Krishna says here, the dami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upayantite. I give them the buddhi yoga, I give them the intelligence by which they come to me. And now, he explains this a little further. Tesham evanukampartam aham agyana jam tamaha nashayami atma bhavosta gyanadipena vasvata. To show them special mercy, I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with a shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. So that's how he does it. He says this anukampa artham, to show them special mercy. I dispel this darkness in their hearts, atma bhavam, gyanadipena bhasva, with the shining lamp of knowledge. So one becomes illuminated within. Because one becomes under the guidance of Krishna. In the beginning, we cannot. Krishna is in our hearts, trying to give us guidance and direction. We are so bewildered we cannot hear. And it says not a good idea in the beginning just to try to hear Krishna talking to us inside. I remember reading a news story and. Philadelphia, where a guy picked up a shotgun and went outside and shot the first person he saw, said God told him to do it. When they investigated, the neighbor's television was was up loud. Somebody was saying, kill him, kill him. He concluded it was the voice of God. You just listen to what everybody says God tell them to do. You know, everybody's just, you know, it was all over the place, right? So we cannot really, in the beginning, hear what God wants us to do. We have to deal with the instructions of Krishna as they come from the outside. From two places, from the devotees, who are already serving Krishna, more advanced than we are, and they can tell us what Krishna wants. And we have books like the Bhagavad Gita, where we find out what Krishna wants. But as we advance, we will find out that we are getting directions from Krishna in the heart, and these two inside, what we are reading outside and what we're reading in, what we are receiving direction inside, these two will come together. And he dispels the darkness. We become enlightened and enlivened, and we are given the capacity we enter into a more and more intimate union with that person who's running the universe, who's controlling everything. Krishna has explained in this chapter his position and his relationship, how his devotees appreciate him, and how he reciprocates with his devotees. Earlier on in this book, Krishna has said, as they surrender to me, I reciprocate with them accordingly. So this is his reciprocation. The devotees approach Krishna in surrender, and Krishna reciprocates in the same way. The word he uses is bhajami. I worship them as they worship me. I worship them. So this is an example of that. So now let's look at text 12 and 13. At this point, here is Arjuna's response. Prabhupada tells us that Krishna is speaking this Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. And Arjuna is as Krishna is the ideal speaker, so Arjuna is the ideal hearer. He's the model for understanding the Bhagavad Gita. So Arjuna says to Krishna like this: Param Brahma Param Dama Pavitram Paramam Bhavam Purusham Shastatam Divyam Adi Devam Ajam Vibhum. You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Param Brahman, not just Brahman, but the Supreme Brahman. You are the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the ultimate abode, the purest, the absolute truth. You are the eternal, transcendental, original person, the unborn, the greatest. All these words are there in Sanskrit. All the great sages such as Narada, Asita, Devala, and Vyas confirm this truth about you, and now you yourself are declaring it to me, he says. So it's not just his personal opinion. You might think that because Arjuna and Krishna are famous friends that he's saying something nice to his friend, but he says, no, this is also confirmed by all the sages. And then he says, Sarvam nitabditam manye yan manvarasi keshva. O Krishna, I totally accept as truth all that you have told me. Neither the demigods or the demons can understand your personality. So this is his reception. So in this chapter, you can see here that Arjuna has actually fully accepted this, that Krishna is the supreme personality. He calls him the supreme Brahman, and in text 15 calls himself the Purushottama, greatest of all persons. There's another chapter which has this title. He calls him Devadeva, that is the God of gods. The God over the gods is the Devadeva. So here he's accepted this in Krishna in the 10th chapter. And then he's asked Krishna to explain some of his opulences by which he pervades this world. And then Krishna gives a long and very poetic description of different things, different kinds of entities in this world, and that of all these entities, what represents him, or what particularly embodies his perfection, that is a kind of a reflection of Krishna. He begins this description on text 20. I am the super soul, Arjuna, seated in the hearts of all living entities. I am the beginning, middle, and end of all beings. And then he goes on. We don't have time to get into these, and many of them have immovable things. I am the Himalayas. Among trees, I am the banyan tree, for example. So in this way he explains all his different entities which represent him, and in a way how, because whatever is great or wonderful or marvelous in this world, now here he says this here in text 41, it's actually in the book, I forgot. Krishna says, know that all opulent, beautiful, and glorious creations spring from but a spark of my splendor. So you may see like that. When you see a beautiful sunset, it's marvelous. And then you can think also, then to even think of how much more beautiful is that from which this has come. So the devotees gradually, everything they see reminds them of Krishna. So he's given all these examples. Whenever you see something that's the best of its kind, you should think that this is embodies the perfection of Krishna. See, if I have any talent or ability, where does it come from? How did I get it? I don't know. I have no idea. All I know is sometimes I want to do something, and it's there. In fact, if somebody has a lot of talents, we say they're what? They're gifted. Where does the gift come from? Who gave it to them? It is Krishna. So he has all these things in full. So that's why one can understand that this is everything you see here is a. Well, he says this, but what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge? For the single fragment of myself, I pervade and support this entire universe. Eka amshena sitto jagat, with a little piece of myself. This is the super soul. He calls it a little piece of myself. I pervade and support this entire universe. So this is the chapter, really, in which we see that Arjuna fully accepting and expressing his realization that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The next chapter, 11, is the vision of the universal form. This is where Arjuna asked to see this form. Krishna has described how he pervades the universe, and so there's a form of Krishna which is called the Vishwarupa, the universal form. Krishna gives Arjuna a certain kind of eyes. He opens his eyes so he can see this form. It's as though you took all time and all space. He showed it to Arjuna in one time and one place. And so Arjuna was able to see the whole extent of the universe. This is described in this chapter. This is a famous chapter because in one sense it looks like the dramatic climax of the Bhagavad Gita. It's an epiphany. It's the one that scholars... there's a famous book by a German scholar, Rudolf Otto, who wrote a survey in world religions of what he thought was a category of human experience called the holy. That's Heiliger. The book is in English, is The Idea of the Holy. This was a fundamental just character of human experience. And he gave the generic characteristics of the human encounter with the holy. And he uses Moses and the burning bush as one example, I remember. And here he uses the universal form. Because one of the characteristics is your hair stands on end, you feel very, very tiny and not a little afraid and so on. So anyway, he shows this universal form. The people who were into acid trips in the 60s, they really liked this. It reminded them of LSD trips. O Arjuna, whatever you wish to see, behold at once in this body of mine. This universal form can show you whatever you now desire to see and whatever you may want to see in the future. Everything moving and unmoving is here completely in one place. You see? Past, present, and future. In space. And so he showed this universal form. So we can see, text 11, Arjuna saw in that universal form unlimited mouths, unlimited eyes, unlimited wonderful visions. The form was decorated with many celestial ornaments and bore many divine upraised weapons. He wore celestial garlands and garments, and many divine scents were smeared all over his body. All was wondrous, brilliant, unlimited, and all expanded. If 100 of thousands of suns were to rise at once into the sky, their radiance might resemble the effulgence of the Supreme Person in that form. At that time, Arjuna could see in that universal form of the Lord the unlimited expansions of the universe situated in one place, although divided into many, many thousands. And then Arjuna prays to him, I see in your body all the demigods, all the extent of the universe. I see Brahma, I see Lord Shiva, I see the sages, I see the Nagas, the divine serpents. I see your... So he sees this huge form of his like this. What it is, we should understand, therefore, that there's a sense in which this universe is the body of God. One of the bodies of God, not the only one, and actually not the most important one. But in the sense that the Lord as the Supersoul pervades this whole universe, the whole universe, when you see the universal form, you see that the whole universe is actually working with a coherent, directed purpose that our bodies work when we want it to do things. So in a way it's like the super soul, but now you see how the super soul is working in everything. So he has this, and it is frightening. And then there's a transformation, and it becomes absolutely fearful, because remember, a battle is about to begin, the battle of Kurukshetra. And now the universal form assumes the feature of what's called the Kala Rupa, the form of time. And he sees now the battle that's about to take place as though it has already happened. But the way he sees this battle is the universal form. All the soldiers are going into his mouths and being crushed to death. And Arjuna is terrified. He says, "Who are you and what is your purpose?" And he says, "I am time. And I am come to engage all people." That's another feature. In the previous chapter, Krishna says, "I am all-devouring death." So this is the Kala Rupa. And basically, remember the whole issue of this Bhagavad Gita, Krishna was wondering whether he should fight in this battle or not. He was a moral dilemma. He was a warrior. It was a just and a godly cause. He was supposed to fight for Dharma. That was his sworn duty. But on the other hand, because of his civil war, the people on the other side were his cousins and brothers, and so teachers. It was a horrible dilemma to be in. What shall I do? Shall I fight or shall I not fight? So Krishna, after showing him this Kala Rupa, this form of time, "Time, I am the destroyer of the worlds." This, by the way, was quoted by Robert Oppenheimer, this very verse, when the first atomic bomb went off in Los Alamos. Oppenheimer knew the Bhagavad Gita. And when he quoted it, he had a different translation: "I am death, the destroyer of the worlds, and I am come to gauge all people." Because remember, as though 1,000 suns rose at once, that's it reminded him of this atomic bomb. Yeah, anyway, so Arjuna, Krishna shows him in this form, and then he says to him, "All these people on the battlefield, they are already killed by me." In other words, it's a done deed. It's already my decision that this battle should happen and these people should be killed. And now you just be an instrument. Nimitra Matam, you simply become my agent. Krishna, for his own purposes, wants this battle to take place, and now you be my instrument. It's not you're worried about your decision, but actually it's my decision. And it's going to happen no matter what you do. But I want you to be my instrument. Of course, in the context, the thing was is that at the beginning, when Krishna appeared, it was at a time where the kings of the earth, that demonic people had been born and taken the position of kings everywhere. And so Krishna appeared. He says in the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, whenever and wherever there's a decline of Dharma and a rise of adharma, of religion and a rise of irreligion, at that time I come. And one of the things I do is somehow curb or chastise the evildoers, the duskritina, and I establish again the sadhus and the path of religion. This is his mission statement. He comes again and again. So at this time, this was what he was doing, acting in the royal order, and so this battle took place. Of course, right now we are ourselves under the aegis of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who appeared 500 years ago. The job is still the same, to kill those who are demonic. But if things are so bad that if Krishna came and simply killed everybody who was demonic, there would be nobody left to save. So his weapon is not like bows and arrows or anything like that. His weapon is the Hare Krishna mantra. And it kills the demonic mentality. So this is a slightly different mission at this time, and one doesn't necessarily involve this kind of warfare. And of course, one has to see. This is a fact. That Krishna's hand is everywhere. Nothing happens without his sanction. And when one gradually has their vision of the whole, you can understand that actually what Krishna is doing is right. I'm not in a position to second guess him. People all the time, they think, if I were God, I could run the universe better. But they have no idea what they're dealing with. Krishna respects the freedom of the living entities. They have their freedom. If they want to oppose him, he gives them the facility to act that out. But still, he's working to establish the devotees, and so he has his ways of doing it. And Arjuna is able to see behind this ferocious feature of the Kala Rupa, there's Krishna, who he knows to be the supreme and merciful Lord. One thing is about this universal form is that it is really not the form of the Lord that's actually much appreciated by devotees. The Prabhupada in the purport refers to it as a godless display of opulences. These are his words. Godless display of opulences. Because Arjuna had a very close and intimate relationship with Krishna, like friends. This is the devotional relationship. And when Krishna showed him the universal form, it blew the relationship. Because suddenly he's just aware of how kindly I am and how great Krishna is. And so his actual ecstatic love for Krishna on this very intimate platform was baffled for a while. And therefore you see at the end, Arjuna begs Krishna, please take it away. Show me your two-handed form of Krishna. And that's what's really ultimately appreciated by devotees. Okay, we've come past our time a little bit. Any questions? Comments? Yeah?
You said Islam conception is that this world is completely different from God.
Yeah.
No connection with God.
Yeah.
And only one person.
The Quran, yeah.
Mm-hmm. If we are going back from that world by following Quran.
Well, when I say Islam, that means the prominent tendency. In graduate school, I had a professor, Ismail Al-Faruqi. This was his vision of Islam. But it's generally that way. The world is wholly mundane, secular. It's just meant for human use and enjoyment. God has nothing to do with it except this one place, the Quran. He came and he delivered the Quran, and that's it. Do I think that going back? Not all Muslims are quite like that. there are different kinds of Muslims. So you have to see, you have to judge this thing on an individual basis. Whether they're going back to Godhead or not. Most of the descriptions I read in the Quran, and the way Muslims talk about it, what their idea of paradise is, seems to be the heavenly plants. Doe-eyed maidens and so on. Like they go to this place where they're pure companions and beautiful women. Every man get. I don't know if women go at all. Every man gets 99 virgins waiting for him and so on and like that. And this is, does sound like a description of Svarga. Huh? The apsaras are there. Apsaras are the dancing girls of the heavenly planets, and so on. So that doesn't sound like a description of Krishna Loka. It sounds like Indra Loka or something like that. Whether they go even there or not, I don't know. I have a god sister who told me that she asked Prabhupada about her grandfather. She was Jewish, and she said her grandfather was a very strict rabbi who followed every single one of the 300 and whatever, 600 and some commandments of Torah. I think 600 and some. There were all the commandments of Torah he rigorously followed. And she said, she asked him, where did he go after his death? And Prabhupada said to her that if he followed, then he went to the heavenly planets. Because even by Krishna conscious standards, you know, the common things that meat eating and so on. But, you know, even that's done in a certain way. There's restrictions and so on like that. Anyway, that's what he told her. I don't know that that's true about all Jews either. I mean, I'm just... Huh?
The Muslim people, they don't worship God with
form.
They think that God is formless,
miracle. Maybe. I'm not sure about that. Usually, what they think I've seen is that God is a person, definitely is a person. The thing is, they don't know what he looks like. And therefore it can't be represented by anything on this earth. It's just like if you read in the Bible, what the Christians call the Old Testament, God is a person. He walks in the Garden of Eden. He does all these things. And when Moses was on Mount Sinai, receiving the Ten Commandments from God, it says that Moses was unable to see his face. He could only see his backside. It's in the Bible. So he has a face, he has a backside. But he could not see his face. Yeah. So my impression of Islam was something like that. God talks, God gives commandments, he's a person, he rewards, he's punishing. So he's not just like impersonal Brahman, but a person that apparently is so great and so majestic and so far beyond us that we're not able or worthy to see him. It's just like in Judaism, God's personal name is so holy, it cannot be said. It cannot be spoken, except on certain occasions by certain priests, under certain conditions. But otherwise, when God is spoken of, they use some other words, but not his personal name. Too holy, or we're too sinful, or something like that. So these religions, their conception of majesty is so great that there's this difference. In each of these religions also, you do find people who have other ideas. The Sufis among Islam, of course, a lot of Muslims regard them as heretics because of it. And I know devotees who have met Muslim fakirs actually in Pakistan, who they worship Krishna. They practice everything that looks like bhakti yoga.
Sometimes they say that in Makkah, Medina, Muhammad, his name was Mahadev before.
Oh, yeah?
And then he turned to Muhammad.
I don't know about those stories.
They said they have pilgrimage in Makkah. Lord Shiva's.
Yeah, they think that the black rock at Mecca is actually a Shiva lingam. They're actually worshipping Lord Shiva. Right. And what will happen if somebody comes and puts Ganges water on him? then Islam will be finished. I've heard that one too. Huh?
Yeah, that's right.
All my friends in the BJP. Yeah. Will he come back? Yeah, he comes back on a regular scheduled basis. Yeah. But actually, in this particular yuga, the Kali Yuga, he's come. As far as we can understand, he came as Lord Chaitanya. And as far as the regularly scheduled incarnations that are predicted in the scriptures, not till the very end of the age, 432,000 years from now. He'll come back as Kalki, the Kalki avatar. But by then, people will be so degraded and so fallen that he will be more or less, he's on a white horse, he's more or less the apocalypse.
Why
did
he say?
432,000 years. You don't want to be around now. You want to go back to Godhead before then. Because this is Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga is an age which is very degraded. Very, very difficult. There has one saving grace. And the saving grace is because it's so difficult. The path of spiritual realization has been made simpler simply by chanting the name of God. So there's a good thing here. But especially because Lord Chaitanya has appeared, it is said that one takes shelter of Lord Chaitanya, one can be freed from all the ill effects of this age. And so it has been predicted that there's supposed to be within Kali Yuga 10,000 years of a golden age of spiritual life, devotional service. 5,000 years up, 5,000 years down. This is very realistic. I personally think Christianity was 1,000 years up and 1,000 years down. 5,000 years up, 5,000 beginning. Actually, very recently, Lord Chaitanya appeared 500 years ago. And, that's what it said. So you have a little window of opportunity. Then everything gets rough again. Yeah.
So is that 10,000 years starting from?
I thought it was at first, but then I talked to some pundits in Mayapur, and they said 1486 is when Chaitanya appeared. So they said the actual golden age really began in 1986, because the first 500 years was a sandhya. Sandhya. You know the word sandhya? It means a transition. Like dawn is a sandhya. Dusk is a sandhya. between some of the ages there's a transitional period. So they said the first 500 years was a Sanjaya, and the golden age of Krishna consciousness really began in 1986. Can you imagine that? You were there for it, huh? That's what they said.
So
it's a
start. Huh? So the golden age.
Well, you know, when things get started, it's a little rough. It takes a while. Really, a manifest. The thing about the Krishna conscious movement, one thing that's really helped me get through some rough spots occasionally is the fact that I know something about the history of religions and the history of Christianity. And I tell you, we don't have it bad. I mean, early Christians were murdering each other. I mean, it was, you know, they're having doctrinal disputes, people were going to jail. I mean, just terrible. Really, really bad. Yeah. You haven't seen anything. It was really rough. There's an interesting book. I forgot the name of the author now. The title of the book is When Jesus Became God. It took about 400 years before the Christians tried to figure out, settle on an idea of who Jesus was. 400 years. And there was the Nicene Council that was established. But it was only because the emperor, Constantine, interfered into the dispute in the church, whether he was equal to God, the same as God, subordinate to God. Nobody, I mean, people are all over the place. There are two main positions. And the emperor, who was the first Christian emperor, really didn't want the people divided. And he forced them to make up their minds. There's a whole description about this, when Jesus became God. It's a fascinating story. And the guy who wrote it is a professor, not of religion, but of conflict resolution. So he thought this was like a really good example. It's out in paperback now. I'm sorry I can't remember his name, the author. When Jesus became God. It's an amazing book. And, you know, if you feel bad about some of the problems we have, you just read this book. Yeah, we should have gone over time. Okay. Thank you very much. I had a good time talking this evening with Bhagavad Gita. It's fun. There's a lot more there too. We just touched on the surface. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. Krishna.